Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, where...
Good afternoon. Welcome to Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. I am your co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And I'm your other co-host, Stas Ciolkowski.
Today is Monday, April 29th, wow. And we're broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. Our theme today is... we just
blue
said it.
And green world.
Stories about our blue and green world.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Stosh. It's so good you're here.
It's good to know I'm good for something.
Plugging the holes in my brain.
Remember the date and all.
Yeah.
That's great. That's my one great contribution to the airwaves.
That's
I know what
not
day it
true.
Is. Sometimes.
And I see you also have a list there of the roster for Stories in the Round. Very good. And a roster for Speak. Well, let me start by saying thank you to Andy Offit Irwin for introducing our show with his original composition, Tarry Here. Thank you, Andy, for being who you are and writing such wonderful material, both spoken and sung. And Stosh, I gather you're going to talk about the Speak Story series right now.
If that's okay, I just happened to have, after last week when I didn't have anything.
Except what was in your head.
Yes.
Which was extensive.
Well, I made sure that I had both the Hagerstown series, Stories in the Round, and the Speak Story series, so that I wouldn't be caught without the information.
With your stories down.
With my stories down. Well, that's good. I like that.
You're free to use that.
Oh, I like that. That gives me all kind of weird images. Yes. And here we are. So, yes, I will mention that coming up in the Speak Story series in May 14th, I'm really looking forward to meeting this lady. Her name is Carolina Quiroga Stultz. And I'm looking forward to meeting her for a number of reasons. One is she's a wonderful storyteller, has a great reputation. She's going to be doing a program about souls of the dead.
Ooh. Is that why you're looking forward?
Well, I'm interested in that kind of story, but also I want to hear her pronounce her name. I really like to know. I wish if you go on a net, you can type in almost any word and find that they'll come up with a little microphone,
mm-hmm.
and it'll pronounce, and so you can sound right. But they don't do it for a lot of names. And so, and I'm particularly fond of people being able to say names correctly, since mine has been butchered all my life. I have been called, instead of Ziolkowski, Zikowski, Wakalewski, things that I can't even believe that somebody looked at it. But lots of times when people see not only Polish names but other ethnic names from different countries, all they do is get confused, and so they make up something, so anyway.
And as a storyteller, we definitely don't like it when people make things up.
Not about our names.
No, that's true.
And, so, in my first name being Stanislaus, I have actually had people in different offices or places. Once at an airline, a woman looked at my ID and said, "Hey," out loud, "we have Santa Claus flying today." And, you know, people looking at me and, you know, and I've had people ask me, "Is your name really Santa Claus?" Because they looked at it's Stanislaus. And all they see is the S at the beginning and the Oz at the end. And they go, "Oh, it's Santa Claus." And they don't bother looking at the other, you know. Anyway, whew, boy, I'm tired already. Carolina is going to be here on May 14th. And on May 15th, she will be telling stories at two schools. And I will be, I will be the wrangler for the first school. That's, I don't know why they use that term, but Adam Booth.
Because there are kids involved.
Yeah. And then take her to lunch, and we'll be met at lunch, hopefully, by Adam Booth and Carolyn Rodas. And Carolyn Rodas will take over the wrangling for the second school. And anyway, I like doing that because going to school as a storyteller, sometimes is you have a little bit of apprehension. But when you just go as a wrangler, you get to be one of the kids and sit back and listen to a storyteller and, you know, pretend you're a kid again.
Okay, so, well, don't get carried away just in case you have to do some actual wrangling.
Yeah. So, and, okay, so, and I'm going to just mention two more of that lineup. In July 9th, Judith Black, coming from Massachusetts, and that performance will be in the Storer Ballroom at 210 North King Street. And normally the performances are at the
Reynolds Hall.
Yeah. But this is a different occasion. And her stories are going to be about climate. She's an educator and did stage training in London at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. Wow. And then September 17th, Claire Murphy is coming from Ireland. And, well, maybe she's not coming from Ireland, but she's Irish.
She's from Ireland.
She's from Ireland. And anyway, that's enough for me to buy a ticket.
Well,
I'd love to hear an Irish person speak.
Well, and this Irish person will just blow you away. What an incredible teller.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, another time we'll talk more
yes.
about Claire
okay,
Murphy.
Okay, so there. That is catching us up to the end of the summer.
Okay.
September. And so now we could go on. Are you ready to tell the story?
I'm ready to ramble.
Yes. Wow, wrangling and rambling on the radio today.
That could be our theme, rambling and wrangling, or wrangling and rambling. Wrangling probably comes first.
Well,
this story...
Alphabetically, it doesn't. But.
Well, then we'd have an argument about which would come first, which would not be at all unusual. The story I'm going to start with on our theme of stories about our blue and green world, of course, starts in my childhood, because so many of my stories start in my childhood, even if they end up on other planets. But many of our listeners have heard me tell family stories about my great-great-grandfather, Henry Barnes, an enslaved African-American who fled Hagerstown, Maryland, about the year 1835, in order to win his freedom. But before that, he'd been educated by a Reverend Barnes, who arranged for Henry's basic education. Henry could read and write and calculate well enough to keep accounts for the work ordered by Reverend Barnes. Reverend Barnes had also arranged for Henry to learn a skilled trade, so he was a gardener and a seed man. And once Henry was educated and had some experience as a gardener, he was hired out by Reverend Barnes to neighbors, to businesses around Hagerstown and Washington County. After his emancipation and settling in Lewistown, PA, Henry became a self-employed gardener and what he called a seed man, living and working in Lewistown, where he married and began a family. Now, I grew up with this family lore, listening to bedtime stories. My dad told me about Henry and Henry's son, my great-grandfather, who left the family a written manuscript that documented Henry's history. All of this historical information was impressive to me at the time, but that did not stop me from indulging in daydreams that really mixed up our family history with popular culture, creating what-ifs and almost fairy tales in my very vivid imagination. Stosh, do you remember that old Disney cartoon of Johnny Appleseed?
I do.
The one where he's barefoot, no shoes, and dressed in his raggedy clothes. He carries a sack of apple seeds on his shoulder and lives outdoors all the time. He bathes in a stream.
And didn't he have a metal pot on his head?
On his head, yes. That was the best part of the cartoon, as far as I was concerned.
I can remember putting a pot on my head, imitating
it. You did it too?
I think every kid who ever saw the cartoon.
Okay. Well, then we're ready for this story. So in this cartoon, he does plant some apple trees, but he's a kind and gentle soul, and everybody everywhere loves him, especially wild animals, you know, bears and wolves. And then there's that song that he sings. So I certainly walked around my house with a pot on my head, and that's part of what this story is about.
I only did it when my mother wasn't around.
I don't remember whether my mother was not around when I put the pot on my head, but I remember walking around, you know, acting out whole stories with this pot on my head. So it wasn't just a one-off, you know, I was into this pot. The earth is good to me, and so I thank the Lord for giving me the things I need, the sun and rain and apple seeds. The earth is good to me. And that, of course, is what is popularly known as the Johnny Appleseed song. But I've learned in the past couple years that it's an old hymn. Mm-hmm. It's a song of praise and gratitude. John Chapman was born in 1774 on a farm next to the Connecticut River. He grew up almost on the water in the old Massachusetts colony. His parents were poor, but the earth provided. They were farmers. And left a half orphan early in life. Let me back up a minute. That term, half-orphan, that's a term that I knew as a seven-year-old when I first saw the Johnny Appleseed cartoon. I knew that word because my dad's grandfather, Henry's son, left those family stories. And in that manuscript that he left to the family, he tells about his own parents' deaths, my dad's grandfather's parents' deaths, just 2 years apart, and how my dad's grandfather came to live at the Quaker-operated New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, but with his tuition paid by his uncle. So the official name for this arrangement with the Quakers was half-orphan, because Uncle Peter remained his guardian, and the boy often went home for weekend and holiday visits. So even though both parents were gone, he was called a half orphan in the parlance of the day. Now, similarly, John Chapman, Johnny Appleseed, lived with his grandparents while his dad, after John's mother died, his dad was away fighting the American battle for independence from Britain with George Washington. He was actually traveling with George Washington. And when the elder Chapman, when John Chapman's father returned to the farm, he brought with him a new wife who quickly produced 10 more children, all crowded into a very small farmhouse. And in spite of John, the Johnny Appleseed, he was not Johnny Appleseed at the time, but in spite of his spending most of his time outdoors, young John Chapman found that household too much for him, and he headed west. So he crossed the Hudson River from Massachusetts into New York State, and he went to work for nurserymen, planting apple trees and delivering second-year apple seedlings to farmers who used those new trees for hard cider. Now, in northern New York State, Chapman became a nurseryman, a traveling man, a businessman, and a waterman. He knew good farmland when he saw it, and he had an eye for valuable acreage, apparently. So this is where he begins his career as an orchardist and learning how to select and identify good areas for planting. And because he rarely owned a horse, he traveled on creeks and rivers, lashing two canoes together and filling them with apples or cider or seedling trees. And at that time in our history, water was generally the fastest way to get produce or other items to the people that wanted them. Now, Chapman's persona, his character in our popular mythology, is a bareheaded, barefooted, holy fool, right? He's carries a Bible with him and makes friends with bears and wolves. Now, it does appear in the history that he loved the great outdoors to the point of foolishness. But in New York State, he also learned to be a businessman. And that shrewdly calculating perspective apparently never left him. But a few years later, he left New York, paddling those lashed together canoes down the Susquehanna River into the Pennsylvania frontier, the place where farms are few and far between, separated by dense forests, the line where wilderness meets civilization. And on the frontier, apples and apple cider were used as hard cash. Cider mills would spring up in a little clearing in the woods. These were not buildings, just a wooden tower made of logs with a hand-cranked mill at the top of the tower. And any strong man, but often John Chapman, would stand at the top of the tower and pour apples into the machine and then crank and crank and crank for hours. So a stream of apple juice fell at a steady pace into a bucket at the bottom. And all the rest, the skins, the cores, the seeds, were directed into another bucket. With all the juice taken out, the mushy leftovers were strained to save the seeds, and the mush was fed to cows or sheep or pigs, whatever livestock you had. So in Pennsylvania, Chapman began planting his own orchards. He really became an entrepreneur at that point. He fenced the trees to keep out deer and rabbits, and he always planted where they'd get plenty of rain or spring water or at the edge of a river, so they didn't need much care. And when the trees were just a year old, he'd dig them up, wrap the roots in moss or rags, whatever was available, and load them into canoes. So in Pennsylvania, he really became John Appleseed. That's what everybody called him because he was one of the few people producing apple seedlings. And most of those apple seedlings were not used for eating apples because if you know anything about botany, I know very little, but I do know that apple trees are one of those plants that don't breed true. That you can, from any one seed, you can get an apple tree that's very different from the tree that it came from. So the usual way to get good apple trees for eating apples is grafting. And that was practiced even back in Europe a long time before this. But Chapman didn't believe in grafting. He thought it was and unnatural, against God's will. And so he only planted seeds, and most of the trees that came from those seeds were only good for cider. But on the frontier, that's what people wanted. They were creating cider to use for currency, really. And there's a whole parallel story about taxation in the United States, the new United States at that time, and Alexander Hamilton's role in taxing the frontier, taxing apple cider. But in the eastern ports, it was taxed in bulk to support the wealthy merchants who produced cider in huge quantities. But in the western frontier, it was for those small farmers, it was taxed gallon by gallon or barrel by barrel. And there was a, have you ever heard of the Whiskey Revolution?
Mm-hmm.
Whiskey Rebellion. Okay, well, so that happened in Pennsylvania. Chapman was probably around during those episodes, and so he would have had some interest in that political turmoil as an orchardist. Anyway, for the rest of his life, even though Johnny Appleseed moved on to new frontiers as Pennsylvania became more settled, he came back to Pennsylvania every year to those cider mills to collect seeds, and he came back to his orchards to collect seedlings to take west and plant more seedling trees. So for more than 50 years, John Chapman sold or gave away thousands and thousands of seedling trees, and it's no tall tale to say that 100,000 apple seedlings went from his hands to the hands of American frontier settlers. And often the trade was a place to sleep on a cold, wet night, or a hot meal, or human company when all he yearned for was conversation. He had friends, really good friends, from Massachusetts all the way to Indiana, from all walks of life, welcoming him into their homes for conversation and stories. And of course, one of the things that John Chapman is known for is the religion, the religious messages that he shared, primarily from the messages of the Church of the New Jerusalem. He carried a Bible with him when many frontier families didn't have one, and he read from it in their frontier cabins. But more often, his evangelism was really focused on sharing the words of Emanuel Swedenborg. John Chapman preached faith in providence and the basic good in man, and shared Swedenborg's other beliefs as well, including his scientific observation and habits of research to document and explain the natural world. So John Chapman was taking notes on apple trees and studying, committing to memory what he learned about planting, about being a good orchardist. He was ordering Swedenborg's books from London and New York and having them delivered to frontier traders in the wilderness. And he often is called the first librarian on the American frontier, partly because of a terrible habit he had. The bookish among our listeners will be horrified to hear, Stosh, that Johnny Appleseed would tear a book apart into chapters and leave one chapter at each cabin where he could find a literate person, making them promise to trade the chapters back and forth with their neighbors out in the wilderness. My mother, the archivist, would have a heart attack if she knew that. So sharing apple trees, religion, and books were at John Chapman's entree into frontier homes. And if you want to be welcomed into a warm frontier cabin for a good meal on a cold night, being known as a storyteller is a good way to eat your fill. I'm going to stop there for the moment.
Okay.
I'm going to link these stories back to my great-great-grandfather, Henry Barnes, but we have other things to talk about first.
Right. Well, I want to just mention, if you think about it, a modern-day librarian would, this is not about your mother. A modern day librarian would be appalled about tearing a book apart and that. But in his day, I think it probably meant that he thought knowledge was better than things.
Yeah, and so, absolutely.
And so the book, tearing it apart in chapters, mm-hmm. I mean, it'd be different if he was tearing it apart and carrying apples in it or wrapping sliced apples up to save for lunch. But, you know, it makes sense to me that he would do that and he could spread the knowledge that he was trying to spread.
Yeah, and people. It means putting people ahead of things,
which I like.
Yeah.
You know, people are more important than things. Knowledge is more important than people.
Knowledge is more important than people.
Yep.
We'll have to ponder that one. The jury might be out on that one.
No. that's a judge trial. No jury on that. That's another one to ponder.
Well, you'd be okay. I might have to marshal my arguments. All right. Well, okay. Before I go on with the story, did we say again that this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia at enlightenedradio.org? Now we did.
Now we did. And this is Stassi Okalski and
Fanny Crawford. And we could also mention at this point that if we are boring you to death at the moment, you could always go to an old podcast and listen to different stories at talltales.enlightenradio.org. Just so you have options, just saying. Okay, I'm going to talk briefly about Stories in the Round, our sixth season in Hagerstown, Maryland, at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 13245 Searfoss Pike, generally the fourth Monday of the month, but not always, so you should check your calendar. If you want detailed information about any specific storyteller, you can contact me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. Or email me at Fanitsky, Fanitsky, @hotmail.com. Coming up on May 27th, we have Elaine Murray coming to tell Celtic stories, personal stories, folk tales, all enlivened with mime and a lot of kinetics. She's a very physical storyteller. Coming all the way from Arizona to share her stories with us on May 27th. That is a Memorial Day weekend, but you'll have time Monday evening.
Monday evening is a great time to finish off Memorial Day with
it
a
is.
Pleasant activity of listening to stories.
7 p.m. That evening at the Unitarian Church. June 24th, Noah Baum will be with us from Tacoma Park, Maryland, and she'll be sharing Land Twice Promised that she created with a... Israeli and lived in Israel for many, many years, and she created this story set with a Palestinian friend and neighbor. And I'm very excited to be hearing it again and sharing it with the community. July 22nd, Donald Davis. August 19th, Andy Offit Irwin. September 23rd, Jim May. October 18th, Dovey Thomason. None of these guys and lady need introduction. These are incredible tellers. Mitch Capel on November 25th, possibly the funniest man in the world, could give Bill Lepp and Andy Offit Irwin a run for their money. Wow. We really need to get him out there so that people know what an incredible storyteller he is. And on December 23rd, a relative unknown, Fanny Crawford, will be still telling stories at Stories in the Round.
She's being overly modest. She's one of the best storytellers you can ever hear.
Well, and it is December 23rd, so people need to put that on their calendars now, or we won't have a full house, because that's right up against many, many, many holidays. Okay. $10 in advance, $12 at the door, 301-730-1638. Stories in the Round.
That sounds good.
I couldn't tell from your expression whether you were going to correct something I said.
I was trying to think of a witty way to say December 23rd was a perfect time to take a break from all that craziness of baking cookies and, you know,
whatever
wrangling
else is
children
is going on in your household.
Yeah, and, but I couldn't think of anything witty about it.
Well, luckily, we will all be tired by that time.
But if you get really old like I am, you don't have to worry about those things. I don't celebrate that way anymore.
Yeah,
which is kind of fun.
It is.
I miss seeing little kids running around. However, I don't miss seeing little kids running around at times.
You know. Okay. So. Well, speaking of little kids running around, I'm going to continue and try to wrap up this John Chapman story, because I want to hear your story too, Stosh, and I don't want to take up all of our time. So we talked about John Chapman and his religious passions, his evangelical work. Once he left Pennsylvania early in his life, though, after he spent a decade in the Ohio River Valley and then continued planting orchards, but still going back to Pennsylvania every year to collect seedlings and distribute them over the territory. He just stayed out ahead of civilization as he moved west. And as farms began to fill the Ohio Valley, he moved to the new frontier of Indiana, along the Wabash River and the St. Joseph River. There's a couple tales told and retold from his Ohio days about the aftermath of the War for American Independence. The British, of course, were not happy about losing their colonies and were sometimes violently angry and allied with Native Americans, who were also a bit ticked off about being pushed off their land. The British armed the Indians with rifles and encouraged them to attack American settlements, provided some backup support for those attacks. And Chapman, John Chapman and his neighbors, loosely speaking neighbors, because there were not very many of them, there was a vicious attack planned by the Redcoat soldiers during the War of 1812, allied with Native Americans. And Chapman and his neighbors, learning of that plan, Chapman volunteered to be another Paul Revere, carrying the alarm to outlying settlements. And the story is he ran 26 miles in a single night over forest trails. Unlike Paul Revere, he had no horse, and he was barefooted to get the word to the settlers in those frontier cabins. The story includes, or the legend includes, the information that soon after he learned of a pending attack by settlers on a Native American village, and he ran ahead to warn those people also. And in fact, there's ample evidence that he was respected and honored in Indian settlements as a sachem, an herbalist, a healer, as well as a skilled and legendary waterman with his lashed-together canoes down all of these rivers, Susquehanna and Juniata in Pennsylvania, and the Wabash and the St. Joseph's in Indiana. He was also, just to be contrary, a vegetarian in a wilderness among men renowned for violence, and many men, if not most men, walked around armed with knives and hatchets, sometimes guns. His legendary meals were straight out of the John the Baptist cookbook. Honey, berries, grain or cornmeal mush. And he mentions, in the stories, he mentions milk, when he could get milk. Apparently that was his favorite food. Hence the pot on his head that you mentioned earlier, Stosh. Because if you can find a bit of corn and milk, you can make cornmeal mush, which is what he lived off of a lot of the time and ate whenever he could get it. So when men called him a pacifist, That was not always said in a friendly manner. He was eccentric in many ways, and above all, made no apologies for living by Christ's teachings. John Chapman died about the year 1845 near Fort Wayne, what is now Fort Wayne, Indiana, in his early 70s, a long and healthy life for a man of his time, living most of the year close to the earth under the open sky. But businessman to the end, his estate included 1,200 acres planted in apple orchards that he left to his sister on his death.
Wow.
Yes, his this sister, I believe, was older than he, so she was not part of the 10 children that eventually drove him from his original home. And they stayed in touch, even though they were occasionally estranged, because he would come to the door of her home dressed in rags and covered in lice, and she didn't always let him in. But they stayed in touch.
Wow.
All his life. So going back to 7-year-old Fanny, who's enamored of the cartoon version of John Chapman, it is probable that watching those cartoons are part of what gave me my affection for trees, probably also the fact that we were a camping family and went and camped in a pop-up camping trailer and a big canvas, green canvas tent for the early years of my life. Probably till I was 12 or so, we were in that big green canvas tent. And I spent a lot of time wondering, after I saw that cartoon, what it would really be like to live wild and to carry with you everything you needed. No tent, maybe a blanket or two, and a pot on your head. And what life would be like. So I have all kinds of tree stories from my early life. Stealing a sumac tree from a neighbor's yard, climbing over fences, so I knew that little tree was going to be destroyed because it was a trash tree in our neighborhood, and I wanted to save it. So I climbed over several fences and dug it up and planted it in our backyard, where it promptly died. I did not have much of a root ball with it. I was probably 9. I did that. No older than 9, because we didn't live in that house beyond that time. Favorite pear tree, Bartlett pears, and that was too tall to collect the pears from on the tree. Didn't have a ladder that high, so we just gathered up the pears and made pear sauce with them as they fell, or fed those pears to the goat. But probably what is most important to me about the John Chapman story is his connection to that young Henry Barnes, because they were both gardeners. They were both seed men. Well, John Chapman was a farmer. Henry Barnes was a gardener, had a very small plot of land. After emancipation, he was able to save enough money to buy a small house and land and marry and raise a family. And thank goodness he did, or I wouldn't be here. And I've wondered, not necessarily at age 7, but more recently, since Henry was gardening and taking care of trees and collecting seeds in central Pennsylvania, not long after John Chapman had passed through there, there were already legends about John Chapman that Henry Barnes would have heard, and if he would have considered him a fellow horticulturalist, a fellow seed man. And I would love to be able to talk to Henry Barnes about botany and seedlings and living outdoors much of your life. Henry Barnes, of course, had a home and a bed to sleep in. But he died young. He died of pneumonia, just as John Chapman did. In his early 40s, John Chapman lived to be 71. But it's, even if you love the outdoors, it's hard being out there in all kinds of weather. and trying to protect your health while you're earning your living can be a daunting task. So that made an impression on young Fanny Crawford, and I want to honor both those guys for their work with plants, especially since we just finished Earth Day, and we're celebrating our big green world. I'm done.
Wow. Well, that was very enlightening. So
this is the enlightened radio.
I know, and that station was not said on purpose. It was an accidental thing. But and I'm learning more and more about you today. Not only did you defy your mother and stay overnight at a party or something.
That's right? A whole different story.
But now I find out you stole a tree.
I did. It was amazing. A weed.
Amazing. Your childhood was far wilder than mine.
Yeah, you probably couldn't have gotten away with climbing over fences in near Patterson Park in Baltimore and digging up people's yards.
Oh, I did lots of climbing over fences.
Oh, okay. Never mind then.
I did travel, and I even traveled through some people's homes.
I remember that story. Yeah. Our primary, forget lashed together canoes. We're climbing over fences.
I actually had only stolen one thing in my whole life, and I actually got so upset about having done it. It was a tiny little toy. I went back to the store on my own and got caught putting it back and accused of being a thief and run out of the store.
That'll teach you to confess.
Even though I was putting it back, the man did not see me take it out of my pocket. He saw me holding it, and it wasn't on the shelf yet. I was putting it back. And I said to him, I was just holding it and looking at it. And he called me a scallywag.
Oh.
Which, that was a long time ago.
Well, and if you don't know what that means, that could sound a whole lot worse than thief.
It sounded terrible.
It's even a political term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he took me by the collar and walked me to the front of the store and said, don't ever come back.
Whoa. For your neighborhood store, that's quite a sentence.
Yeah, but he didn't know me. He didn't know me. I just looked like 50 other kids that went around that neighborhood. There were lots of us little guys in that neighborhood.
Well, since we are still in story mode, and I have emptied my bin, your listeners, you are tuned to enlightenradio.org, and this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour with Fanny Crawford and
Stasz Ciolkowski.
And now it's Stasz's turn to tell a story.
Right. And before we leave, before we part today, I need to tell you about a brilliant idea I thought of as you were telling. For a number of us. So that's good. Yikes. I didn't mean to get you that excited. Okay, so you talked about the land and about trees and dirt and things. I'm going to tell a bit about my dad, who was, I consider him, he was my best friend. And he loved the water. He loved fishing. He loved being on the water. And when I was a kid, up until shortly before I went in the Army, my mother would often say to me, when my father was going to go fishing on a Saturday, my mother would corral me sometime around Thursday and say, your father's going to ask you to go fishing on Saturday. And she didn't have to say much more than that, because she had emphasized to me early in my childhood that I should love to go fishing with my father. And the older I get, the more I think maybe she was saying that because if I was out fishing with my father, I wasn't there at the house and causing her some trouble underfoot or something. And the time I'm talking about now is when I was young enough that I did not do a lot of the chores yet. Once I got to be old enough to do a lot of the chores, like scrubbing floors and doing windows and that, my mother loved having me around. In fact, I was required to be around at her beck and call. But my father loved to go fishing. And we would go often on an early Saturday morning, and he would take all the required fishing poles, not poles, but fishing rods, and his tackle box, and probably 3 packs of Raleigh unfiltered cigarettes. My father was an extremely heavy smoker. I don't think he ever, until near his death, he probably never went a whole day without 2 packs of cigarettes. Also a large thermos of coffee and a few bologna sandwiches. And more than just a few, because that was my favorite at the time. And we would go, and often on those Saturdays, we would go and rent a rowboat, which I think cost the princely sum of about $3 for the day. And I remember my dad using $1 bills to pay for the rental. And then we go out on the water, and we went to, I can't even try to get the river's name correct, because I was not very good at paying attention to where I was, except that we would go to one of the rivers, rent a rowboat, and it would be a river that emptied out into the bay. And so that we would often wind up near the bay, sometimes actually, I'm guessing in the bay, but close to shore, not way out. And then we would sit, and my father would fish, and it only took me a couple of these expeditions to find out that I really didn't like fishing. I didn't have the patience. Also, I didn't work like my father. He was a gas construction foreman, and that meant that he was in Baltimore City and Baltimore County digging up the streets and the roads, fixing gas pipes or putting in new gas pipes or troubleshooting gas leaks. And it was a difficult job, and he was on call for gas leaks, especially twice from the time I was born until probably when my dad was in his 50s. He was involved in a gas pipe explosion once. He was hospitalized and then stayed home for a number of months because of his burns. And I really believe that he liked sitting on the water, putting his fishing line in the water, and occasionally getting a bite, once in a while even catching a fish. And it didn't matter to him that we caught fish or didn't catch fish. He was just able to relax, wasn't working, and didn't have to think about anything except being in a pleasant place. And I learned to like that very much. I actually, when I moved to Arkansas in 2006, the day after we got there, I bought a boat. And even though we lived there for 6 years, and my wife Terry swam every time we went out in the boat, unless it was in the wintertime, and we used the boat hundreds of days a year. And I was in the water once in 6 years, but I loved being on the water in that boat. And sometimes I would even take it out by myself and just go for a ride on a 44,000-acre lake, which was very pleasant. So I understood that about my dad. Well, one particular time, we were a bit out of the river and into the area of the bay. And actually, my father was pointed out a couple of things. And one of the things he pointed out was a small island in the bay, not too far from the shore of and the river. And I was curious because in my mind, the word island meant that it was a pretty exotic place and there might be buried treasure and all this. But he explained to me it was just a bit of land sticking up out of the water and that nobody lived there. Just there were some bushes and things. Well, we were on the water for a couple of hours when my dad said something like, uh-oh, or oh no, or something, and had a very concerned tone in his voice. And I said, I called my dad Pop. I said, what's wrong, Pop? I was about 9 years old at the time, maybe 10. He said, we need to get off the water. There's a storm coming, and it seems to be coming fast. When he pointed this out and pointed back over his shoulder, it looked like somebody had a big black blanket and they were lifting it out of the water across the sky. And the clouds were so dark, and it truly looked like someone was going to cover us up with this blanket. And my father set the oars and began rowing. Now, my dad at this time was a big man. He was only 5'11" at his tallest, and he weighed about 250 or 60 pounds, and he was barrel-chested. He was very strong. He began rowing and said, we're going to go to that island. And before 10 minutes had passed, waves were actually hitting the side of the rowboat, and some water was splashing in the boat. And my father told me to get off the seat and sit in the bottom of the boat, where I was actually sitting in water a little bit now, and to just hold on to the seat in front of me. And I have intense memories of looking at his back as he was rowing, the front of the boat being behind him, and he was pulling hard on those oars. And it seems like in my memory that it took us an hour to get to that island. I think it was probably 10 or maybe 12 minutes. But by the time we got to that island, my father was so exhausted from pulling against the current and the waves, which had gotten quite high and rough, that when the boat hit the sand, my dad turned, picked me up, set me on the sand, and said, move away from the water. He got out of the boat. There was a rope on the boat, of course, and an anchor. And he pulled the boat up a bit on the sand, laid the anchor down behind some bushes, and then he actually collapsed on the ground. And I was terrified because I thought he had died. And I went and sat next to him, and he was breathing hard, and I remember crying. And he lifted his head and said, it's okay, I'm okay, I just am exhausted, and I need to rest. So we sat on that, I guess you could call it the beach, and we were both soaked because it began raining and just poured. And it didn't last long. I guess the best thing about this adventure, besides that we weren't hurt or anything, was that it was all over in maybe 15 minutes after we got to the island, and the storm had passed. The sky wasn't as dark, and my father announced that he thought we probably were finished for the day. We did have fun bailing water out of the bottom of the boat because the rain had put quite a bit into it, and he pushed the boat back into the water. We got in, and he rowed us to the place where we had rented the boat, and on the way, he sang. He sang some songs. One of his favorite songs was about Mr. Moon. They liked to sing it when he was in the car about Mr. Moon. And right now I can't think of the, I can't remember the words, but anyway, it was Mr. Moon, bright and silvery moon, won't you please shine down on me? That were the words. And he had me laughing. Probably did it on purpose because he knew how scared I had been. So hard because there was no moon. And he kept pointing to the sky each time he said the word moon. Anyway, we had a great story to tell when we got home. And I can remember telling some of my friends, Johnny and Russell and Joe and Stan, about us being in this terrible storm and how it took my father over an hour to get to the island. And luckily, there were no pirates or anything on the island, and we were safe. So,
boy, oh boy, what a story!
And it's true.
Yeah,
it is true. We have a few minutes left. I would like to say tell another short story.
Oh, please do.
When my dad was a lifeguard when he was a kid, he loved swimming. He was very strong. And once, when we were visiting friends at Cape St. Clair, I believe the place is. It's down near the Bay Bridge. It's a community.
I've seen that.
Right.
And when I went to Annapolis last month and
right.
passed right
it's,
by there.
Mr. and Mrs. Zepp, Z-E-P-P, who are very good friends with my parents and who often visited in Baltimore at our house on Saturday evenings. And we would sometimes go down to the Zepp's place. And on this particular day, it was a Sunday, and we were coming home. It was towards Sunday evening, but it was summertime, so it was still light out. And we were crossing a small bridge, and I have no idea what road we were on, but we were crossing a small bridge that was over water, but it was the kind of bridge where the sides of the bridge were low, so you could see the water. And some of the bridges, especially if you were short like I am, you'd sit in the car, you couldn't really see because the bridge would be in the way. But I was sitting between my parents. I was in the front seat, and my mother screamed, "That man fell out of the boat." And my father pulled to the side of the road, kind of stopped, leaned over and looked, and my mother was pointing. There was a boat in the water, and my mother said, "That man stood up, and I saw him fall." And so my father went forward with the car, drove to the end of the bridge. It was not a very long bridge, and drove off the road down the side, the slope, down to the edge of the water, stopped the car, and I could try to describe it, but it would be impossible to describe exactly what happened. He kicked off his shoes and his pants and dove into the water and swam to that boat and began going under looking for the man. And while he was on his way to that boat, another man who was down the shore a ways came running up the side. He too kicked off his shoes and his pants. Later on, I thought it was very funny when it was all over to see my father in his underwear and the other man too. That man swam out to the boat. And apparently someone in a house right near this place had called either for an ambulance or the fire department, but my father and this man took turns diving and trying to find the man. When the, I don't know, it's like the rescue people showed up in no time, they actually had a boat with them, put it in the water and went out, and they began, I don't know if it was dragging or something or anything, but we were there for about 40 minutes before they hooked the man's body with them. And I remember as a kid, it was a pretty terrifying thing. And my father and the other man talked for a little while. The rescue people had given them towels to dry off and everything, and even said, my father, the man said, you could take the towel if you need it. You know, it was, by now it was cooler in the evening. And I remember my dad saying, no, we have a heater in the car, which I thought was so strange to say, you know, in that circumstance. But he put on his pants and put on his shoes, got back in the car, and didn't say a word until for the rest of the evening. Didn't say anything about it until we got home. And in fact, didn't want to talk about that at all. It wasn't until I was probably, I don't know, maybe before my dad passed away, as I was an adult, that once I talked to him about it, and he said, he felt very bad that he couldn't have saved the guy, even though he was able to go there quickly, and that he and the other man had talked about that. They both felt guilty, but because of that incident, they became friends. And I didn't know that. He told me this years later, that he and the man stayed in touch with each other and occasionally went fishing together.
I was going to ask you that. What you were telling, if they exchanged phone numbers. And wow. We're going to talk about that story another time, but we're over time, so we need to close. Thank you, Stosh.
Oh, you're welcome. That's the first time I've ever told this story.
Well, you'll need to tell it again.
This is Stosh Ziolkowski
and Fanny Crawford
closing today's noontime broadcast of the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. Independent community radio from Bolivar, West Virginia. Tune in next Monday at 12 noon for more stories. The Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all our stories. Join us next week, same time, same URL, for more storytelling. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for
Johnny Diamond.
Johnny Diamond.
Richard Diamond.
Or Johnny Dollar. Richard Diamond. Richard Diamond.
Those famous detectives.
Right.
More unsolved matters.
Right.